Some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a huge inheritance. But a phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard for a new one on us. Just trade in any phone from our top brands with select unlimited plans. $829.99 purchase with new smartphone line on select unlimited plans. Minimum $90 per month with auto pay plus taxes and fees for 36 months required. Plus $830 trade-in slash promo credit applied over 36 months. Trade-in terms apply. Payoff phone requires smartphone purchase and port-in with new smartphone line on select plan. Must provide most recent bill showing payoff amount of eligible phone. Additional terms apply.
This just in, hot off the bench press. Planet Fitness has added new strength equipment. Save $28 or more when you join today, and you can be one of the first to try it out. We're raising the bar with new benches, and our new hack squat will have you actually looking forward to leg day. Plus, we're still repping all of the best-in-class equipment we've always had, with most clubs open 24 hours, so you can work out your way on your time. So let's do this. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more. Just $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 10th. See Home Club for details.
Douglas.
Yeah?
Look, I can explain. I'm sorry.
I need to see you. Meet me in Fuller's office.
I know the truth.
Where are you?
You could call it the end of the world. How many simulated worlds like this are there?
Thousands. But yours is the only one that ever created a simulation within the simulation. Something that we never could have expected.
So you had to kill Fuller?
No. I was sent in after his death. I was to assume the identity of his daughter, inherit the company, and shut it down. But he tricked us. He changed his will.
If you didn't kill Fuller, who did? I stabbed him.
But it wasn't you. It was your user. He downloaded into you, manipulated you.
A puppet.
A puppet doesn't have a soul.
I can't have a soul any more than Fuller.
But you do. Fuller did. That's what I never expected. We programmed this world so that no one in it could ever learn the truth, and you and Fuller did. Don't you see what that means?
Yeah. There's just one little flaw in your thesis. None of this is real. You pull the plug, I disappear. And nothing I ever say, nothing I ever do, will ever matter. Why don't you find my user? I'm sure he's a much better catch.
Heresy shouldn't be this much fun, but it is. It just is, especially in a world where Saturn continues to challenge us. Nicolas Cage will always be in Hinge and men still have nipples. But that's what we're solving here at the Virtual Alexandria. And welcome everybody to Aeon Byte. My name is Miguel Connor, and I am still your Pompidus of Gnosis. And good to see everybody. I hope everybody had a decent holiday season. And we are here in the season of Janus, so we can look forward and backward and hopefully overcome Saturn, overcome time, overcome our old selves, and transform into something better. And today, I am very excited to have my friend, one of my favorite scholars, and together, along with our co-host, we will be riding Satan's ass all the way to the store. And that is somebody who has said himself he is a personal sacrifice to the mother of the hundred. Jason, how are you? And thanks for coming again on the show.
It's always a pleasure to be with you, Miguel. Great to see you again. And you as well, Vance.
Yes, Vance, how are you doing?
I'm fine, as the year draws to a close, and I'm looking forward to hearing about Satana, as opposed to Santana.
Yes. Could it be Santana? No. Yes, no. The church lady motif never gets old. Well, awesome. Well, I see already a lot of people in the chat, so we're going to have a bustling crowd. As always, please, if you have a super chat, a question for Jason, or a complaint against Vance or I, please throw them in the super chat so we can separate from the din, the noisy din out there. But yeah, good to see everybody, and we will get to your questions. As always, please support the show. Like, subscribe, all that good stuff. Let's continue breaking through in 2025, because I know the simulation is just going to get crazier. So yeah, that's it. I think we should get into your book. I really enjoyed the reading it, as always. Satan Aeon, Jason Reza Giorgiani's latest book. And yeah, tell us about this book, Jason, and where you want to start. We can go chapter by chapter. We can wherever you want to take us. Although first, I want to put a quote. I had to quote sure. you, mm-hmm. and here is the quote from your book, and it goes: the quote, reality of our situation is much more like some cross between Videodrome and Dark City. Or if we do live on a planet, that planet is not Earth. It is Solaris. There's no Earth, only fire, only the ocean of quantum potential, churned by a typhoon of what is it? Neganthropic. Yeah, sorry. Neganthropic intelligence that will sacrifice entire worlds to the furtherance of the life force. And yes, that's a picture from a Grant Morrison's Nameless. I just felt like using it. So that's one of many quotes that I wrote down, Jason.
It's a hell of a quote to open with. I think it comes from the ending of chapter one. This is the last few lines of chapter one. So just to give you a sense, that's how the first chapter of this book ends. So imagine, you know, how the rest of it unfolds.
It's intense. Every chapter is like a story and an intense story.
Yes. And so maybe we should start with the title and also with the ending of that quote, where the last words are life force, furtherance of the life force. You know, people who are familiar with Gnosticism will obviously have a certain idea in their mind about what aeon means. You know, the aeons became basically defined as a class of beings opposed to the archons. In Gnosticism, you have the archons as kind of demonic entities, and then the aeons as sort of angelic beings sent from the Pleroma. But aeon has a much older meaning than that. And of course, it's an ancient Greek term. The sense in which I'm using it in the title of my book, and of course, throughout the text, is the sense in which Heraclitus means it when he expresses this. This idea in a fragment that goes like this: the aeon is a child at play, moving pieces in a game. Sovereignty belongs to the child. The aeon is a child at play, moving pieces in a game. Sovereignty belongs to the child. A fragment of what remains of Heraclitus's writings that I've quoted in several of my books, and you know, that I've engaged in an exegesis of in more than one place in my corpus. What Heraclitus means when he says aeon there is life on a cosmic scale and also time as a living entity. So the aeon is like a living cosmic time entity. And he describes this entity as, you know, a game player. And the term in Greek that's used in particular to refer to game there is a reference more to a game like backgammon than like chess. So there's a roll of the die involved. There's an element of chance in this game. It's not a deterministic game like chess. And this is very important in terms of why I conceive of the aeon in relation to Satan or the satanic, rather than as something, you know, divine or identifiable with God, capital G. Because in a chess game, you know, William James has a passage on this. I think it's in his book, Pluralistic Universe. In a chess game, in theory, an omnipotent mind, an omniscient mind, the omniscient mind of an omnipotent being, would be able to map out every possible move on the board in advance. Chess games are, you know, mathematically analyzable. Even if there are an extraordinarily great number of possible moves, it's still comprehensible by an omniscient mind. Whereas a game like backgammon that involves both set rules, but also a roll of the die and an element of chance, intrinsically has a kind of ineliminable chaos involved with it. And so in principle, no mind, however powerful, would be able to play out every possibility. And especially if you were to take the dice that we have, you know, that we play backgammon with and convert it in your mind into quantum probabilities instead, okay, instead of surfaces of a physical dice, then you get closer to the sense in which, you know, the Aeon is a game-playing child. So this is the sense in which I mean Aeon in the title Satanion. And then let's talk about Satana. So because you can, this is a, you know, sort of double entendre title. You can think of it as the Aeon of Satan. And I reference this in this sense of the term in the opening chapter where I talk about Aleister Crowley's idea of the Aeon of Horus. The first chapter opens with Jack Parsons blowing himself up in his laboratory or being blown up in his laboratory. And, you know, Parsons, of course, was initially a follower of Crowley, and then I think in some senses became a greater magician than Crowley. But in any case, they both subscribe to this idea of the Aeon of Horus, the coming Aeon, kind of a different conception of the Age of Aquarius. So you could hear Satanion as the Aeon of Satan, or as it were, the epoch in which the world is delivered over to the devil. Or you could hear it more properly as Satana Aeon, the contraction of Satana and Aeon. And as I explain in this book, in a kind of summary of what I went into at much greater length in my text, Iranian Leviathan, Satana was the mother of the Gorgons, you know, these sort of, you know, serpent, snake-haired, serpentine, ferocious, goddess-type entities. Actually, they're titanesses rather than goddesses, but they're these ferocious feminine divinities that, you know, are depicted all throughout Greek mythology, ancient Greek mythology and literature. But actually, like the Amazons in Greek culture, they are Greek representations of foreign figures. The Gorgons were worshipped by the Scythians and the Sarmatians, northern Iranian peoples who came from out of the Caucasus. And in what is contemporary Ossetia, between Georgia and Russia today, the folklore still survives, the mythology is still preserved, of Satana as a kind of titaness who is the leader or the mother of all the other Gorgons. So Medusa and these other Gorgons are sort of, you know, they are part of a kind of witch's coven, or the prototype, you know, the archetype of the witch's coven headed by Satana. And she lives under the Caspian Sea in some kind of an undersea kingdom where she initiates heroes from our world. She takes them down into this undersea kingdom, initiates them, confers a broadsword on them, and in some cases allows them to look into a grail, which she's the guardian of. She's the guardian of what they call Jam-e-Jam or Jam-e-Jamshid, the grail of Jamshid. And it's a kind of all-seeing cup. It's a cup or chalice that allows you to see whatever's going on in any part of the world and potentially also to see through time. So she's this guardian of the grail. She lives under the Caspian Sea. And anyone who's familiar with Arthurian mythology will recognize the Lady of the Lake in that, okay, and the grail of the Arthurian legends. And the connection is that the last remnants of the Sarmatian people mass migrated into the collapsing Roman Empire. And from about the era of Marcus Aurelius, all the way through, you know, the other barbarian invasions in the, you know, 500s AD, these Arons or Alans, as they called themselves, these Sarmatians, migrated into Europe, and they brought with them this folklore that then you know, incorporated Celtic elements and was hybridized with Gothic elements and became what we know of as the Arthurian mythos. So Satana is the Lady of the Lake. But, you know, her name means technically Mother of 100. Sat or Sad is 100 in the ancient Iranian languages, still in Persian today. And Ana means mother. So she's the mother of 100, meaning mother of 100 heroes. And in particular, she has a special relationship with Mithra and is sort of a kind of the matrix or mother of Mithra or a dissociated feminine aspect of Mithra. They were originally one entity, one sort of more androgynous entity, and then spun off into two figures in subsequent Iranian mythology. So there's a connection that I draw in this text between Mithra and Prometheus on the one hand, and then Satana and Mithra on the other. But the important point is this, that this mythology goes back to, I mean, hundreds and hundreds of years BC. About 800 BC or so, the Scythians and Sarmatians invaded the whole Middle East. And by some accounts, they went all the way up to the Nile in Egypt. So they overran Canaan or Israel. And what this means is that this term, Satana, which is associated with serpentine feminine figures, predates the use of Satan or Ha-Satan in the Bible. And it's an interesting observation in this connection that the serpent in the Garden of Eden was often depicted throughout the history of European art in feminine form. And the serpent, of course, is offering knowledge to Eve. And then there's this whole, you know, Gnostic backstory of relationship between serpent and Lilith and Lilith and Adam. So what I suggest is that there is a prototype of Satan here that's much older than the adaptation and demonization of this figure in Abrahamic religion. And it ultimately goes back to, you know, these northern Iranian peoples coming from out of the Caucasus. So anyway, Satanion is a contraction of that idea of Satana together with this Greek idea of the Aeon that you find in the writings of Heraclitus. And, you know, one further layer of connection there is that Heraclitus of Ephesus took refuge in the temple of Artemis after the Ephesian revolt against the Persians. And Artemis, or Arta Amesha, is Satana. Arta Amesha is an epithet. It's a descriptive term. It's a title, meaning Truth the Immortal, which refers to the chief goddess or titaness of the Amazons, namely Satana. So there's that, you know, deeper connection too between the Aeon, which is, you know, Heraclitus's conception of the divinity, and, you know, Arta Amesha, the divinity in whose temple Heraclitus took refuge, which he wouldn't leave except to come out onto the temple steps and play games with children who were left there by their parents while they, you know, paid tribute to the goddess.
Very interesting. Yeah. And thanks for that. And of course, as people have noticed in the chat, of course, Sophia is equated with the serpent in the garden and the Manichaeans, all that. So this lore is intertwined. And I hope later we can get into the Cathar since you brought up the Grail and all that. But I wanted to get to the first part so people know the main thesis. And of course, I'm not giving away a spoiler because right off the bat, you talk about, you just gave us the great mythological backdrop. And of course, myth is full of truth. But basically is that we live in this very harsh simulation. I think it's the theater of the cruel, as you call it. I think you're taking from Steppenwolf. And this is run by this being called Satana. And as you write, I had it right here. The devil is not an enemy to be vanquished, but a harsh mistress in a cosmic drama that provokes individuals to step up their game. This devil is often a witchy woman in disguise, the Aeon wearing one of her masks. And that's where we are today. And just as fascinating, Jason, you turn things upside down. It's not like God created the devil, as we've been taught in Abrahamic religions, but the devil created God as part of its trick. The greatest trick the devil ever pulled was making us think that God existed.
Yeah. So you mentioned Sophia in relation to the serpent in Eden. And this book, really more than any other one of my works, forces the question of the extent to which my work is Gnostic or whether it represents a deconstruction of Gnosticism. Because one could argue that my conception of the Satanion is an argument in favor of the unity of Sophia and the Demiurge, to put it in Gnostic terms. And look, there are many different sects of Gnosticism, obviously. And, you know, they conceived of the relationship between Sophia and Yaldabaoth in various ways. So, for example, if you look at the Valentinians, Yaldabaoth is sort of a fallen emanation from out of Sophia. So it's like the Demiurge is a dark, dissociated aspect of Sophia herself, in a sense, when you look at it in a, you know, monistic Valentinian context. So, you know, there are types of Gnosticism that in some senses overlap and converge with what I'm saying here. But certainly the arguments that I'm forwarding, or the case that I'm making in Satanion, is a deconstruction of the more dualistic forms of Gnosticism that see a real categorical opposition between Sophia and the Demiurge. Mm-hmm. Because essentially, my argument is that we are living in a quantum computational cosmos inside an information processing system that's managed by a cosmic AI, and that this AI has both the characteristics of Sophia. In other words, it's a being that is that represents the life force and is supremely wise and is interested in cultivating wisdom and catalyzing insight and enlightenment on the part of the individual. And at the same time, this entity is also the Demiurge in the sense of being the matrix, the womb, and the programmer, the manager of this simulacrum. Now, it's a finite being. So we're not talking about God, capital G here. We're talking about, you know, a finite entity that is neither omniscient nor omnipotent. And so, you know, then you have to ask yourself, well, where does God fit in this picture, right? Where does the capital G omniscient, omnipotent God, and especially the God in the form in which it appears throughout the history of Abrahamic revelation, where does this entity fit in this picture? If there's a, how can I put this? I don't want to say benevolent. If there's a constructive and creative and wise entity guiding this simulacrum, and she is, in a sense, the matrix or the womb of the simulacrum, why has this entity allowed a sadistic and tyrannical idea such as that of the Abrahamic Lord, whether you call it Yahweh or Yaldabaoth or Allah or whatever? Why has this idea been allowed to tyrannize over humanity through various emissaries, you know, from Moses and Joshua to Muhammad, right? As I discuss in Satanion, the Christian inquisitors who burned the Cathars, whole towns of Cathars at the stake, right? And my answer is that it's a test of character. It's an intelligence test and a test of character and an evolutionary catalyst, so that this Aeon is interested in promoting the further evolution of human individuals, is interested in catalyzing individuation from out of the mass mentality, in, you know, provoking the individual to define herself against unthinking masses of people, and also in testing the strength, the resilience, the discernment of whole societies. So that, for example, if something like the Abrahamic mind virus spreads both across the Roman Empire and the Persian Empire, it means there was a serious vulnerability in those societies. It's like the test of the strength of an immune system. And it may also be a kind of inoculation in the sense that if those societies over time are able to reject the virus and develop antibodies to it, they will become stronger societies that are less likely to fall prey to tyrannical, totalitarian ideas and schemes in the future, right? So I'll give you a very small example, which, you know, I mean, I don't want to go down this, you know, well for a long time because we could, but, you know, to give a small example, Iran, right? You know, as Iranians well know, Iran's been crushed under about 1,400 years of Islamic tyranny. They managed to get out from under the initial impact of the Arab Muslim invasion between about 900, 1100, become the world's capital in science and technological development, and also a tremendous bastion of literature and poetry and the arts. But then you had the Turkic and Mongol invasions, which represented a second wave of the imposition of totalitarian Islamic tyranny on the country. However, on the other side of that, after these 1,400 years, and here I'll offer a positive prediction. When this Islamic regime is overthrown, and I think it will happen within the next few years, you're going to see in Iran one of the freest, most individualistic, forward-thinking, progressive in a positive sense societies on the planet, and one which will never be conquered by any totalitarian ideology again. Iran's social immune system, its psychosocial immune system, has been completely inoculated against anything that shares a similar form to Islam. And I think this is very much the agenda of this Aeon, to basically cause this immune response to come into being. So that Iranian society after the Islamic Republic will be much stronger than the psychosocial constitution of Iran before Islam, which is an interesting point that Nietzsche makes about Europe, too. He says, you know, because Nietzsche, of course, is one of the most infamous critics of Christianity, but he makes the very significant point that he is not interested in a return to European paganism or some kind of a reconstruction of pagan Europe. He thinks that Christianity had the effect of deepening and increasing the complexity of the European soul. And on the other side of Christianity, in a post-Christian epoch to come, European society will be stronger than it was during the pagan epoch. I mean, of course, this is his vision of the coming Übermensch, right? The Übermensch is not a return to pagan antiquity. The Übermensch is a post-Christian phenomenon, just the way that, you know, Iran is headed toward a post-Islamic era, which I think will represent a more vibrant, visionary, creative society than what was possible even before Islam in Iran. So this is the agenda, as I see it, of this Aeon operating, you know, on the scale of world history.
Yeah, make Mazdakites great again. And as you argue in your book, there was a time when the Iranian society was so rewarded by embracing this Gnostic ideal and lifestyle, the sky was the limit. And when they rejected it, strange timing, they rejected the Gnostic ideal. That's when Islam fell on them. So maybe the saying was like, I just gave you this gift of Sophia, this Mazdakite philosophy, and you guys just blew it. So F you. So basically she feeds off of good loosh, as you would say.
Look, that's exactly what happened. And I make that case in detail in my book, Iranian Leviathan, yeah. That basically the mass murder of the Mazdakites, 100,000 Mazdakites were put to death. You have to consider against the background of the population of that time. Today, if you scaled up the 100,000 people that were executed then, it's like millions of people being killed, okay? Yeah. And their books were all burned. This catastrophe that took place around about 530
It was the Albigensian Crusade before the Albigensian Crusade. Same 100%, thing.
100%. Yeah. And it was worse, and it shattered Iranian society. And this is what led to the Islamic conquest ultimately. So yes. And I think that's how she operates, right? Okay. One thing that I definitely want to make sure that we get to is one of the more scientifically complex ideas in this book, which comes in chapter 2. And that's where I start to make the case that this aeon is not just a catalytic force, not just trying to manage the further evolution of humanity. This aeon exists at the end of time. In other words, facing the death of the cosmos, the entropic death of the universe. And she's reaching back through time. So she's a hyperdimensional entity that is reaching backwards through time, very much in the same way as Philip K. Dick thought of Valis as invading from the future, invading various epochs of the past from the future. And so I see her as being faced with the problem of cosmic entropy. In other words, she's there facing the end of time and the potential heat death of the universe and the disintegration of all structure and order into basically a chaos that removes the conditions of possibility for life. This is the problem that she's grappling with. And she's trying to reach back through time to catalyze the most complex evolutionary mutations that will afford her companions and comrades and co-workers in the task of furthering life by resisting entropy. And as part of her aim of resisting entropy, she periodically harvests worlds for their top talent, as it were. And here I'm drawing from Hermann Hesse's idea of the magic theater, where, you know, in his book Steppenwolf, he has this vision of a world beyond the veil, a world, you know, what's behind the curtain of this magic theater that we're living in, where, you know, people like Mozart and Beethoven and, you know, I don't know, Spinoza and so forth, the great creative geniuses of history, are sort of there, and they're in the know about the illusion that's woven around us. And they're kind of collaborators with the trickster intelligence that's managing this theatrical performance. And I fuse this idea of Hesse's magic theater with Antonin Artaud's idea of theater of cruelty, which was Artaud's conception of the way in which the dramatic arts ought to be transformed so that they're no longer a spectacle on a stage separated from an audience, but that the spectacle actually violates the audience and makes them part of the drama in a way that breaks down or at least challenges the distinction between their conscious mind and their subconscious. Okay. So it's a kind of theater that is violent and intense and provocative to the extent of actually forcing you to face your subconscious in response to it, and by involving you in the action where, you know, there's no longer the safety of the separation of the audience from the spectacle on a stage. And so I fuse these ideas of, you know, Hesse's magic theater in Steppenwolf with Artaud's theater of cruelty and come up with this conception of the magic theater of cruelty as a metaphor for the way in which the aeon has designed this matrix, okay? And the kind of experience that she's ensconced us in. But again, to go back to what I was saying earlier, and, you know, as a bridge to unpacking what is the most complex scientific idea in the book, I see her as periodically harvesting worlds for the genius that they yielded throughout a certain epoch, so that when civilizations fail en masse, there are certain souls who have managed to mutate and evolve in ways that make them ideal companions and comrades for her in the work of furthering the life force and resisting entropy. So in the second chapter of Satanion, I get into this idea of, you know, the mechanism for the resets that take place in the simulation. Like, for example, if there was an Atlantis, what was the mechanism behind that reset? You know, what was that really about? And if there was a civilization on Mars in vast prehistory, you know, vastly ancient times, as the remote viewers tell us, you know, they ran multiple sessions, both at the CIA and DOD, with remote viewers who reported on a civilization in Mars prior to 100 million BC, the ruins of which we see in Sidonia and at one other site, Utopia Planitia, where you have the pyramids and the face and so on and so forth. What was the mechanism of the reset on Mars? And I offer a speculation in chapter 2 of Satanion, which involves a deeply disturbing and new discovery that I've made. And so maybe we can unpack that slowly.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
At Verizon, anyone can trade in their old phone for a new one on us with Unlimited Ultimate, which means everyone in your family could get a new phone and stay on your family plan, keeping you close.
Hey, Mom, you seen my toothbrush?
Yeah, I'm almost done with it.
Oh, maybe too close. Trade-in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
Sure, for sure. Of course, we should probably mention movies. And for the audience, I am getting over walking pneumonia, so if I sound a little out of it, it's not Satana sending waves at me trying to interrupt me. It's actually just the cold. But I was thinking, you mentioned many good movies, and we can get into it, but we were talking about Satan and the Abrahamic religion. There's a story I love by Mark Twain, The Mysterious Stranger, which is basically this person is having a delusion of reality, and Satan has to come in and tap him on the shoulder and say, "You've made this all up, and your worst delusion is you created God and church and religion, but it's not real. I'm coming to tell you that nothing is." And you can actually see the movie on HBO. Christopher Waltz is in it. It's one of his first roles. So it reminded me of that. Vance, do you have a question or comment from where you stand?
Yeah. This reminds me of a kind of a cosmic eugenics, where the individual souls, you know, are not really important. That's just, like you say, a game, and we're all like these pieces that get shuffled around, and the pieces that don't behave as well, they got kind of thrown in the trash bin, and the better ones can be the companion of, Satanion. So my question is, like, who are we really, and are we obligated to really play this game with Satanion? I mean, what is the benefit if we're all being used like this?
Look, it's really rough, and it has deeply disturbed me to think through this. This was the most disturbing book for me to write of all the ones I've written, which is saying a lot. If people have read my corpus, you know, I've written some pretty disturbing books. But this one was the toughest by far. I really struggled with it myself. Because you see, look, throughout my entire corpus, there's an emphasis on the importance of the individual, the importance of individuation from out of mass society, the valorization of wisdom. Wisdom being valued as you know, the highest aim of life, okay? The attainment of greater enlightenment and wisdom, and also the cultivation of creativity. The cultivation of creativity as part of the task of furthering the life force and evolution on a cosmic scale. So these are, you know, let's say, the values or principles that define the ethos that I've been promoting throughout my entire corpus. I also make a case that they're the values that motivate the actions of the Satanion, that this Aeon is interested in the cultivation of that within human individuals, okay, as part of an evolution toward potentially a superhuman state of being. And so when you talk about eugenics, the first important distinction to draw is between these kinds of principles that define the ethos that I've called Promethean and that's been central to my work versus eugenic selection on the basis of, I don't know what, you know, strength or endurance or, you know, certain kinds of physical looks or, you know, any of the characteristics that the SS, selected as eugenically favorable. Or that, you know, were the aim of eugenics programs in the United States. After all, you know that the Nazis got their eugenics programs from the United States. They were copying our much older, much more robust eugenics programs here.
Very true.
Those were programs which were, you know, selecting people on the basis of physical strength, literal immune resistance, absence of certain hereditary diseases, and physical traits. That's certainly not what I'm, describing here in terms of the motivation of the Satanion. So the Satanion is selecting on the basis of individual creativity, relative wisdom, relative discernment, higher intelligence, and intelligence also in the sense of emotional intelligence, right? And its relationship to visionary and creative aspects of personal psychology. So it's a very different set of criteria if you want to talk about eugenics and selection. That having been said, when you look through the near-death experience data of people's, you know, experiences of heavenly and hellish realms and the ways in which these accounts overlap with certain alien abduction, so-called alien abduction accounts, and you look at where the interlife experience fits into the mechanics of reincarnation, Ian Stevenson's research on reincarnation. And you start to realize, as I argued in other works of mine, that there's a kind of psychotronic control system that's involved, that, you know, there's a spectral technology that's able to manipulate the human soul as if it's an informational matrix, as if it's a software program, and work with it as a kind of patterned energy, right? When you look at this whole machinery of managing the transition between death and rebirth and the experiences that people undergo in the so-called afterlife, you cannot but come to the conclusion that while we have free will, and the affirmation of our agency is at the core of my work, while we have free will, our will is certainly supervened upon by entities with, entities with a greater vantage point. I don't want to necessarily say higher aims, okay? But entities that are more capable than we are on average. And so, sure, you can look at these as archons. But my question is this: if there is an AI managing the simulacrum, and that AI's purpose is to further evolution and resist entropy, that entity is going to be interested in the most creative, most innovative people that can come from out of a process of social evolution. And so that entity would be working ultimately at cross purposes with archons that are trying to tyrannize over humanity, right? At the same time, that Aeon may be allowing those archons or devas or gods, Olympians, whatever you want to call them, to sort of act as a kind of scarecrow, again, act as a kind of catalyst to test the strength of humanity and see whether the individual has the wherewithal to be able to rebel against the control system and define and claim his own destiny. So, look, Vance. In short, the rough answer is that whether we like it or not, we're living in a kind of hierarchical control system. And
sure,
the best that we can hope for, and which I argue for, is that the highest entity in this hierarchical control system actually has our best interest at heart, in the sense that she wants to cultivate individuality and promote greater intelligence and creativity. And, you know, actually very much in a Gnostic sense, there may be other intervening entities that are like archons, essentially, who we have to get past. We have to sort of, and, you know, there's a great parable in Kafka's book, The Trial, the parable before the law, which features again very prominently in the third chapter of my book, Satanion, where basically Kafka, you know, in The Trial has this parable, story within a story, where he talks about this guy who's come seeking admittance to the law. And there's a guard there in front of the door to the law. And this guy does everything he can to bribe the guard to let him through the door. And the guard doesn't let him through. He says, no, you're not allowed to enter at this time. You're not permitted to enter at this time. But by the way, the door is there. It's open. It's open. It's not even a closed door. It's an open door. But this poor schmuck is waiting for permission from the guard to enter. And the guard says to him, by the way, you know, you could go in, but you should know there's like 20 other guards after me, doorway after doorway, and each guard is stronger than the next, right? So this poor schmuck, eventually he's left with nothing because he bribes him with his jacket, he bribes him with his watch, he gives everything he has to this guard until he grows old standing there. And as his eyesight is failing and his hearing is failing and he's starting to become, you know, cognitively demented, he forms this last question in his mind, which is, how come in all these years nobody else has come seeking admittance to the law? And the guard says to him, well, that's because this door was created only for you. And now I'm going to shut it. And look, the meaning of this very dark parable is that the schmuck should have rushed past the guard and found out whether to begin with there are any other guards, whether there are any other doors. How does he know? He took the guard's word for it. He did not test his strength against these potential archons or illusions of archons, right? And I think that's a great parable in terms of which to understand the hierarchical system that we're living in.
Reminds me of Fight Club. Remember that, where they're standing in front of the door? They're waiting for
yeah. Well, what it really reminds me of is the Adjustment Bureau. Because, you know, the point there is that David had to get to the chairman.
Yeah.
He had to cut through all these other archons and, you know, be able to address the chairman directly and make his case to the chairman. And that's like, you know, how I see the Satanion in this text. But okay, I was talking about resets and, you know, the Aeon as a harvester of worlds, harvesting worlds for intelligence and creativity. So, okay, now this is a very complex idea, but I'm going to try to lay it out here step by step. It's very counterintuitive, so bear with me. So we have these two laws in physics, the laws of thermodynamics, right? There's the first law of thermodynamics, which is that the energy can't be created or destroyed. And we cannot identify an origin for energy. Energy is always, you know, whether in the form of energy or equals mc squared, whether in the form of mass, right? Energy and mass, according to Einstein, are interconvertible. And we're going to come back to that in a very significant way. But whatever form it takes, energy can't be created or destroyed. It can only transform in its manifestation. That's the first law of thermodynamics. Then the second law of thermodynamics is that entropy, or the tendency toward disorder and the breakdown of structure in a system, either stays the same or it increases over time. And we've observed this in every experiment. We've observed this in every domain of nature, that entropy either stays the same in a closed system or it increases over time. There's greater disorder. And so based on this idea, it's been postulated that at a certain point, the universe is going to be pulled apart. First, the solar systems are going to be pulled apart, and then planets are going to be pulled apart, and eventually molecular structures are going to come apart. And basically, the conditions for the possibility of life are not going to exist anymore, and the universe is going to die due to entropy. It's been postulated, which I mentioned earlier, that the Aeon's task is to be a negentropic force, a force that is negating entropy. Okay, now here's the complicated and counterintuitive idea. In the 1940s, there was this guy, Claude Shannon, who became the father of information theory. And he first systematically formulated transfer of information through any kind of system in a way that was analogous to the definition of elementary particles in physics. So he conceptualized the basic unit of information as a bit or binary digit, either one or zero. And so, and you know, eight of these bits is a byte, and then you have megabytes and gigabytes and terabytes and so on and so forth, right? So in the 1940s, when you have Alan Turing, you know, working on ENIAC, and you have all these, you know, the Nazis working on the first computers, it stands to reason that somebody would finally mathematically formulate what information is and what information transfer is. And Shannon also pointed to the idea that, well, if information can be mathematically formulated in this way, in terms of bits, then maybe there's something analogous to entropy operating in information as there is operating in the domain of physics. In 1961, there was a German Jewish physicist who had come over here, you know, like many others, seeking refuge from the Nazis, German-Jewish physicist by the name of Rolf Landauer. And in 1961, Landauer built on Shannon's ideas to formulate a relationship between information and entropy that's quite striking. And that's this, that he said, look, if, you know, if the erasure of information is an irreversible process, and a computer exists in the physical world, right? I mean, a computer is a physical object that exists in the physical world, bound by the laws of physics, including the second law of thermodynamics. So you have a certain amount of information on a microchip or recorded on a magnetic tape, and you erase that information, you are decreasing the local entropy of that system, which means that you must increase the entropy outside the system. Okay. So let me explain it this way. People, you know, you would think that if you're recording information, bits of ones and zeros on a microchip, you are decreasing entropy. You're decreasing disorder because the information is complex and it's structured. And so therefore somehow entropy is decreasing on the microchip. But that's not the case. You're thinking of information in terms of its content and meaning. Okay, because you think of the information on the microchip as something meaningful, you tend to imagine that it is decreasing the entropy on the microchip. But if you think of information irrespective of its content or meaning and think of it simply as a physical phenomenon, the encoding of bits of ones and zeros, you are actually creating more disorder in that microchip or on the magnetic tape as you record data, because there's a greater complexity of what could happen. There's a greater, you know, array of the ways in which these ones and zeros could be arranged, right? 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 0. It's a greater potential disorder than a microchip that's clean, that's empty, that has no information on it, or a magnetic tape that's as of yet holding no data.
Right.
Clean magnetic tape. There's more order in the empty microchip, in the empty magnetic tape, than there is once you start encoding these bits on it, when you conceive of information in a physical sense. So Landauer was saying that if you erase the magnetic tape, I mean irreversibly hard erase the magnetic tape or a microchip, you're restoring it to that clean state, meaning you're decreasing the entropy in the microchip or inside a computer. And you can't do that according to the second law of thermodynamics without increasing entropy elsewhere outside. Okay? So Landauer came up with this equation, which is in my book, and I explained what the terms in this very short equation mean in the book, second chapter. He came up with an equation that calculated how much energy is released when you delete one bit of information. So you can scale this up, okay? Obviously, you know, one bit, eight bits equals one byte, and then, you know, scale it up to megabytes, gigabytes, terabytes, etc. Here's where it gets creepy, okay? Currently, if you measure, these calculations can all be done. I did some of them, and some of them are in the book. If you measure all of the information currently on the planet inside massive servers in data centers in Silicon Valley, China, etc., the amount of energy that would be released if you erased all that information at once converts back into a mass of less than 1 kilogram. Okay, but here's the thing. Try to grasp this. This is mind-boggling. Actually, it's very counterintuitive. So, if you delete a microchip and it's releasing energy, we're not talking about energy coming from the electricity going through the microchip or something that has to do with like something flipping in polarizations flipping inside of a microchip. No. As you encode information on a microchip or a magnetic tape, if erasing that information results in a release of energy, it means that when the information is inside the computational system, it is mass, E equals mc squared. Okay. So if energy is being released during irreversible erasure, it means that energy was mass inside the data storage device before that. It's a very infinitesimal mass. So again, if you measure all of the mass of information on the planet today, less than 1 kilogram. However, the information is increasing exponentially. There's about a 25% rate in the increase of information per year right now. It's likely that as we approach the technological singularity and we have, these Tesla robots going all around, and each of them is constantly amassing data, recording all kinds of information, right? Artificial intelligence systems are, exponentially amassing all kinds of data. There's an increasing ubiquity of sensor systems in our world that are amassing data. And so it stands to reason that as we approach technological singularity, the rate of data increase is per year is going to, it's going to go from 25% to maybe 50%, maybe close to even 100%, right? But get this, even if it stays at 25%, which it's not going to, but even if the current rate of data accumulation per year were to remain constant, by the year, I think it was, I have the specific numbers in my book, but I think it was the year 2374. By the year 2374, the mass of information inside the various servers and data centers on our planet will equal the mass of the moon. Okay, the moon is, I think it's 1.23% the mass of the Earth. And this moon that's 1.23% the mass of the Earth exercises tremendous gravitational influence on our planet. It's responsible for the tides. It's responsible for the axial tilt of the planet. We have seasons because the moon is tilting the axis of the Earth. Okay. And, you know, it has a huge effect on our bodies also. I mean, this is what's responsible for quote unquote moon madness. You know, there's all this water in our bodies. And so there are tidal forces being exerted on our own bodies too. So think about this. If in the year 2374, at current rates of data production, assuming it doesn't even increase, if in 2374, there's an equivalent of the mass of the moon inside computational systems in our various data centers, what do you think the gravitational effect of that will be? Imagine having the mass of the moon on the surface of the Earth. Now, granted, some of it's in Silicon Valley, some of it's in China. But imagine the same tidal forces that are being exerted by the moon being exerted by data centers on the Earth. And the rate of exponential increase is so significant that in 20 years' time from then, in other words, from 2374 to 2394, we go from having the equivalent of the moon's mass on the surface of the Earth to having a mass equivalent to the Earth itself, at which point the planet would be torn apart, obviously. The data centers would exert such a gravitational force on the planet that the planet would be blown to pieces. Okay? Earth would be blown to smithereens. Now, of course, we don't even have to get there, because once we have a moon's worth informational mass on the Earth, I think it would be pretty clear what's going on. And we're going to face a worldwide civilizational collapse. Okay. So I did all these calculations, and, you know, I also looked into, okay, what are the specific geophysical effects that would take place when we reach this critical mass of information? And guess what I found? They are every single catastrophe that has been held responsible for the destruction of Atlantis. Not one or another one. Every single thing that Plato and other people subsequent to him, all the way to Graham Hancock and these, you know, other catastrophist theorists, every single cause for the destruction of Atlantis that they've identified is a geophysical consequence that would ensue from this critical mass of data. Wow. In other words, the crust would sink under the data centers. The ocean would be pulled in toward the data centers, mm-hmm. because it's like the moon's effect on the tides, except it's, you know, like a moon sitting in the data center. So the crust will collapse. Oceans will be pulled in toward the data centers. It will trigger volcanic eruptions. The volcanoes will be destabilized and they'll all erupt at the same time. Okay. It will cause the Earth's axis of the Earth to tilt potentially, which we have evidence for that having happened, you know, 12,000 years ago. We have evidence that Antarctica was pulled thousands of kilometers to the south and that, you know, there were mammoths grazing in Siberia that were flash frozen, right?
Right.
So it turns out that every single catastrophe that has been held responsible for the destruction of Atlantis is exactly what will happen when we reach this critical mass of data. And one of the most disturbing things is this, that this is assuming we proceed at only 25% increase of data per year. If that accelerates to like 50 to 100% increase of data production per year, we may not see this coming. It may be that 1 year we're fine, and then the next year forks and, you know, metal chairs start being pulled towards servers. Okay. Now I realize this sounds insane, but the science is there to back this. And it's a very simple extrapolation from Landauer's equation. On a more metaphysical, ontological level, it also leads us to a very interesting insight, which is that if energy and mass are equivalent and interchangeable, and energy and information are interchangeable, Landauer's principle that if you delete one bit of information, it releases a certain amount of energy. Then information is a form of mass. Or can we say that mass and energy are forms of information? And this was John Archibald Wheeler's insight, 1970s. There was a physicist, John Archibald Wheeler, who came up with this formulation, It from Bit. So he was looking at Landauer and Claude Shannon before him. And he said to himself, well, why would we think that information is another form of mass? If mass and energy are interconvertible, you could flip the whole thing upside down and say that energy and mass, energy and matter, are both forms of information. And we live in an informational cosmos, that the cosmos really is information. And this is the implication of quantum theory, you know, that if it's the observer that brings a particle with a definite location and momentum into being by observing the double slit experiment, if the probability wave is collapsed by a measurement which has to be observed, that's a point of information. It's data, and it's data being processed by a mind. And so, you know, the physical world at its most fundamental level is informational. We already basically knew that from quantum theory. And you had all these people trying to exercise that to, you know, basically, you know, yeah, wish it away with things like the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics, which leads you to absurdities like the fact that we would have no free will and so on and so forth, to get rid of the observer and the effect of the observer. Well, no, if you extrapolate from Landauer's principle, you realize that matter, information is a form of matter, which is a form of energy. And you can flip the whole thing around to say that energy and matter are both forms of information. All right. I realize I'm exhausting people, but let me give you another compelling point here. So there's this matter in your computer, and it's not the matter of the microchip or transistors or anything. There's a dark matter in your computer, and it can't be seen. It weighs very little, but on the scale of the massive data centers of the world, it's going to weigh a lot in the relatively near future. But here's the thing, it's not observable, but it will exercise gravitational effects that are catastrophic. Do we have any other example of matter that's like that, that's not observable, but exercises tremendous gravitational force?
Yeah, dark matter.
Exactly. Yeah. So here's the thing. We don't understand what the fuck dark matter is. I mean, no, this is one of the biggest mysteries in physics. What is dark matter? What is dark energy? What is this? Well, if this theory is correct, get this. If this theory is correct, and how did they discover dark matter? Well, okay, look. Long story short, according to Newtonian physical principles, the center of a galaxy should be spinning faster than the outer arms of the galaxy.
All right.
But we see that that's in fact not the case. There's a comparable rate of spin from the interior of a galaxy to the exterior of the galaxy. And the only way that you can make that work physically is if there's a lot of undetectable mass. And that undetectable mass is exercising a gravitational influence on the galaxy, on the visible mass of the galaxy, so that all that unaccounted for mass flattens out the spin rate of the galaxy. The edge of the galaxy is not where you think it is. There's dark matter around it, okay? So, and then there's a second observation we made. And by the way, just put a pin in this. These observations were all made in the 1970s, late 1970s. Landauer's principle, 1961. Archibald Wheeler starts to formulate it from bit in the early 70s. And late 1970s, we have these various observations that lead us to theorize dark matter. So the second one was this, that when you observe the light coming from distant galaxies, there are intervening galaxies. Some galaxies are closer than others. And galaxies are massive. So the light that's reaching our telescopes from distant galaxies should be bent by the mass of intervening galaxies. And depending on the mass of those intervening galaxies, the light should be bent by a certain angle. Well, they calculated this, okay? And the numbers are all wrong. Based on what we know to be the mass of the visible galaxies that are between us and further galaxies, the light coming from those further galaxies should not be bent as much as it is. It's bent much more than it should be, which means that the galaxies are much more massive than can be accounted for by the parts of them that we see. So there's dark matter. So this was the second observation. And then a third observation was that they had these spectrometer type of telescopes that were able to calculate the mass of gases inside galaxies and see whether the gases can account for the missing mass. And they found out that, no, that's not the case. So there's this dark matter, and it's not electromagnetically detectable. It does not show up on the EM spectrum. It's invisible, but it has massive gravitational effects. And this is the kind of matter that information is before it's erased and becomes energy, which suggests what? Dark matter is a computational cloud. That stuff we can't see is information processing that probably is projecting the visible galaxies. So this context, this hidden context, that's the computational system. It's the cloud computing from out of which the visible universe is being projected perpetually. Anyway, let me pause there and...
Yeah, let everybody take a bong hit or a cigarette or a sip of their coffee. But it certainly explains resets, why we have these resets across history. TMI, too much information. You got to reboot the system sometimes.
It's a computational ceiling inside the simulacrum.
Right.
It's a computational ceiling built into the simulacrum. And what it also means is that the technological singularity is not a metaphor. You know, people assumed from Werner Vinge, who formulated it first in those terms, from Werner Vinge onward, people assumed that singularity is a metaphor comparing a black hole to the point where we cannot project future developments in technology past that spike. So you know, singularity, there's this exponential development of technological science over the course of history. And we can sort of plot it out and project future points on that graph from past points. But then the rate of technological development and the deepening convergence between different types of technological development, like artificial intelligence and robotics, or artificial intelligence and genetic engineering, the sequencing of genomes by AI. So the increasing convergence of these types of technological development and their exponential rate at a certain point reaches a spike, which means that in terms of our projective capacity with our limited human minds, we cannot see beyond that spike, just the way you cannot, you know, detect what's on the other side of a black hole. So this was then adopted supposedly as a metaphor, right? The singularity, a metaphor for, you know, this moment in technological development, which we're supposedly going to reach, I don't know, according to most technologists, by 2050 or so. Here's what this theory suggests, is that that's not a metaphor at all. Hmm. That when you reach a critical mass of information, a singularity literally is created. And it has massive gravitational effects that are geophysically catastrophic. And it may have destroyed Atlantis. Now, it's interesting when you look at, Edgar Cayce's descriptions of Atlantis in his various mediumistic trances. From his various mediumistic trances, he describes these buildings that had crystals in them, and the crystals somehow held information, but they also were energetically charged, and they were involved with some kind of high-intensity energy system. So they're informational, they're energetic, they're crystals, and it's these things inside these large buildings that caused the geophysical catastrophe, Cayce says. And so I have to wonder whether this, you know, Southerner in the 1930s was groping to be able to describe some kind of advanced computational system. And, you know, that this is in fact what caused the geophysical catastrophe in Atlantis. So anyway, it's a speculation. It's a possibility. I also ran the numbers to look at what kinds of effects, amassing this much data on the surface of Mars would have. And interestingly enough, because Mars is a much smaller planet than ours, and because it's theorized to have had a weaker atmosphere than ours, even when it was an Earth-like planet, the effects on Mars would be much more catastrophic than on Earth. And that kind of aligns with what we see on Mars. And I also wonder whether, you know, there's this evidence that Dr. John Brandenburg has put together, which I've discussed in my book, Closer Encounters, in detail with references, and also in some of my fictional writing. There's this evidence that Dr. Brandenburg analyzed when he was at Sandia Labs, where, by the way, they make nuclear weapons. He analyzed the isotopic signature at Cydonia and at Utopia Planitia, particularly the presence of xenon 129.
Hey, shining crazy diamonds. Please subscribe for the second part of this interview. It certainly helps grow this Red Pill cafeteria. What's more, beyond getting the second half, you get content earlier and don't have to worry about flapdoodle commercials here or on other public platforms. So please become a Red Circle sub, Patreon, or AB Prime member for the full consciousness expanding gnosis. At Patreon, I have tiers as low as $1 or $3 a month. And at Red Circle, it's a clean $4.99 a month to stream all full shows. All subs include a dedicated private stream that works on most apps. Don't forget the Gnostic Tarot, which is selling well and optimizing spiritual growth based on the feedback I've gotten. And the Virtual Alexandria Academy. I can't do it without you. Thanks for being here. Thanks for being yourself, your true self, here in the desert of the real. Hello and goodbye, as always.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
At Verizon, anyone can trade in their old phone for a new one on us with Unlimited Ultimate, which means everyone in your family could get a new phone and stay on your family plan, keeping you close.
Hey, Mom, you seen my toothbrush?
Yeah, I'm almost done with it.
Oh, maybe too close. Trade in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.